Hello, this is Ron Falk for the Department of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, and welcome to the Chair's Corner. Today, we welcome Celeste Lee, who has done a tremendous body of work in the general field of patient engagement. She's a member of the Kidney Health Initiative, which is a public-private partnership between the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and the American Society of Nephrology, and she is on the board of directors and with the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, or PCORI, she has played a role there as well. What is very interesting about Celeste Lee is that she has been a professional in academic environments, but she's also a patient who's had vasculitis and is seen by Dr. Jenny Fleith, who is a nephrologist at the UNC Kidney Center. Joining Celeste today is another very interesting human, Dr. Daniel Lee, who is Celeste's caregiver. But Daniel Lee has, in his other life, is the chair of a major department in the UNC School of Public Health. So our conversation today is going to focus on patient engagement, what it means, how patients can become active participants in their care, and then also what it means to be a caregiver and the importance of a caregiver in patients' care. So welcome, Celeste and Daniel.
Thank you so much for having us here.
So, Celeste, you and I have known each other for a while, and during that period of time, I've come to know you as this astonishing leader and ferocious advocate, and I think that's the right word, for the process that is known as patient engagement. So what does that word actually mean to you? What does patient engagement mean?
Yeah, thank you so much, because that is, you know, nowadays people are throwing around the word patient engagement, patient activation, patient-centered care, right? There's a lot of funding that's available for these types of efforts, but they get interchanged in a lot of different ways. So the way that I like to really acknowledge or to set the stage for the true definition for patient engagement is two ways. There's two parts. One is that there's a way that patients can be personally engaged. And that means, what does it mean for me as Celeste, a patient with vasculitis, and I'm also on dialysis, right? What does it mean to me to actually be engaged in my healthcare, right? To understand what is my illness and then how to care for myself, to be engaged and to partner with my doctors, with care providers, with nurses, with patient care techs. How do I do that, right? So that's a level of personal engagement and patient engagement. The next level is what I would call public form of patient engagement. So that means someone like me who's worked really hard to be as engaged and activated in my care as I could be to make sure that I truly understand and are the expert of my own health. And then how do I take those skills that I've learned, those self-management, those self-efficacy skills, and how do I help others and other patients learn how to adopt them themselves? And so that's my public advocacy or public patient engagement arm, or how do we get other patients to be engaged in helping physicians, researchers, and everyone learn how to develop design questions and ask the right questions that are really meaningful to patients. So it's almost like advocacy, if you will, but teaching people how to become better advocates for other patients like themselves.
What advice would you give to a patient, an individual patient, to become an advocate for themselves, to actually be engaged in the physician-patient relationship?
Yeah, and so this is so perfect. Just this last week, I'm from Boston, and when I was in Boston, I used to, for fun, I used to be an actress. I did regional theater, and it was just a wonderful place to be. Met a wonderful woman, good friend for about 25 years. She just emailed me, or actually did a message to me on Facebook, and was just diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. And she had been healthy her whole life, but didn't have access to health care. And she said, Celeste, I know you've been doing this for a long time. I know you were on dialysis when you were here, and I really admired that. Can you help me figure out what to do? Because right now I am stifled. I don't know what to do. And she's very smart. So that we had a conversation, and I said, this is what you need to do. One is you need to take a breath, you need to breathe, and you need to understand what your diagnosis was and understand that that diagnosis is not who you are. And what the treatment they're suggesting are not necessarily what you're going to do right now. What you really want to do is you want to learn and treat this as an adventure. You want to start to partner with your physician, ask questions, bring a notebook, bring, if you can, someone with you, because it's, you know, when you hear someone talking to you like your physician, you hear want, vasculitis, want, rituximab, want, but you don't hear all these other things, and you need someone to be with you. But it's to take an, you know, to take the tools that you can have to help capture the information that you might miss at first. When I was first diagnosed, I had a wonderful young physician who said to me, he literally was just started his practice, and he said, Celeste, you're going to have a really long journey in your healthcare. We're diagnosing you with Wegener's at the time, with GPA, vasculitis. It's also affected your kidneys. What I think you need to do is you have a choice to be in the passenger seat or to be in the driver's seat, because you're the one who's always going to be driving, and we, the healthcare providers, your doctor, your healthcare team, is going to be, people are going to be coming in and out of the car all the time. And you're the one who's really the driver. So that's kind of how I've led my life, and that's how I help other people, is to try to take the driver's mentality.
If you're the driver, mm-hmm. and you have to be, I completely agree, because if you're not, it's your journey.
Yes.
How do you help physicians realize that they are passengers?
So the way that we help physicians is, I talk about partnership. And so let's just say, you know, Dr. Falk, you and I just got acquainted with you, and you're doing a second opinion for me from somewhere around the country. And what I would ask is I would say to the physician, you know, you're the expert of what's in your toolbox to help me. You have all these wonderful tools. You know how to use them and when to use them usually. Now, I'm the expert of myself. I know who Celeste is. I know what I've experienced. And so what I'd like to be able to do when I first meet with a physician is saying, I'd like to create a partnership with you, because that's what I really need. I need someone to partner with me to help me know what are the tools that are available, what are the best ones for me given what's going on. And then I can tell you a little bit about who Celeste is, where she is in her life, where she is in her journey, and kind of in my own way have assessed what the risks and benefits are that I'm willing to take for me and you helping me make the right choice.
And how do physicians usually respond?
They respond so wonderfully. They're so happy to have that happen. They want to be with someone as a partner. And here's what I say to patients now, because, as you know, patient-centered care, patient engagement is really starting to come into the lexicon of healthcare. There's a lot of patients who are starting to understand that and learn about it. But what they kind of end up doing is being a little bit disrespectful and a little hostile towards physicians and healthcare. If they find something on the web, they might bring it to the doctor's office. And instead of saying, what do you think about this? Is there something? They say, why didn't you tell me about this? You missed this, in a kind of a hostile way. And that's not what this is about. This is about you and I being partners and engaging with each other, because together with this partnership, and a unique partnership that it is, we should be able to make the best decision for me, which physicians want to do. So I've always had very positive responses from my healthcare team.
How do you get patients to be willing to say all the things that you've just said, but it's hard to say those things in an opening stance at the beginning of care?
It is. It's really hard to say it. So the way that I had wanted to do this is, let's just say, you know, because the audience of the people who are listening to this podcast might be physicians, right, might be nurses within the Department of Medicine. What you want to do is you want to have the physicians and the healthcare team be open to allowing that patient to understand that they want to partner with them, right? So it might not actually be the patient who initiates that type of relationship. It's where the healthcare provider initiates that relationship, saying, I'm very interested in what your thoughts are and how you feel and how I can provide information for you that makes it helpful for you to understand. It's a complicated, you know, the disease process that you have is complicated. The words are complicated. But we want to make them as accessible to you as possible so that we can work as a team.
What would you have told your 17-year-old self? Mm-hmm. You were diagnosed with this disease when you were 17. Mm-hmm. And now many, 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 many moons later, what advice do you give to yourself?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question because that's, quite honestly, that's what motivates me to keep doing the work that I do is because when I was that 17-year-old girl in upstate New York, I was isolated. I was alone. I didn't have anybody who knew about what was going on with me. And what I would say to her is what my physician said to me. He was the most instrumental person in my life. And it was, you know, Dr. Riccardi, young rheumatologist, just came from UCLA. And he's the one who said, Celeste, you're young, you're smart. Healthcare is going in all these different ways. I highly suggest that you read this book called Anatomy of an Illness by Norman Cousins. He's a wonderful writer, but he basically said, and this is what I'd say to her, is that this is your life. It's your life to learn and to not give up on and to treat it as an adventure and to help others do what you do and to connect with them so that, you know, the hardest part about any one of these illnesses is the isolation and the loneliness. No matter what disease you're being diagnosed with, that is, I would say, the largest obstacle and sadness that comes into chronic illness. And the only way we can really work with that isolation and loneliness is to partner with our doctors, to partner with our healthcare team, and more importantly, to learn how to manage and know our disease and help others learn how to manage and know theirs, to create value and meaning in our lives. And that's what happens when you get disease. And so that's what I would tell my 17-year-old self. I'd say, learn, do as much as you can to talk with your doctors and do as much as you can to reach out and help other people.
And as you grew from a 17-year-old with a new diagnosis through treatment to eventual kidney failure, what would you have told yourself along the way with all the ups and downs so that you could remain as engaged in your care as you have been? Because that's the remarkable part of your journey, is that instead of becoming isolated, you have done exactly the opposite. That phenomenon is unusual because as illness waxes and wanes, patient mm-hmm. engagement can wax and wane mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. What do you tell yourself in the downtimes?
So this is what I tell myself in the downtimes, is that they are downtimes. It's like the ocean, right? The ocean, you know the ocean's going to come in, but you know it's also going to go out. So when you have any chronic illness, there's going to be times that you're lonely, you're depressed, you're isolated. You let yourself feel that because you know that the water's actually going to go back out again and you're going to feel a little bit better. But I can tell you this, no matter how ill I've been or how I've felt not very good, the thing that has always given me reason for living, for choosing to keep going, has been my interaction with my other fellow patients, to not make it all about myself. And it's, even though when you think you want to do that, by interacting with other people, it's a distraction. You get away from yourself. It's like you're not navel gazing any longer. So as you go through these ups and downs in your journey, and this is what's missing, is we don't give patients the opportunity enough, and we don't ask them enough to help. Because when you ask them to help, to talk to another patient, when you ask them to say, we're going to be changing the way we're setting up our clinic, and we want to make sure that when we have patients come into clinic that we're doing it right, would you mind being on this work group with us? By asking that patient, you are giving them a reason not to be isolated and alone, right?
Right. Daniel, you have been Celeste's caregiver. How do the vicissitudes, the ups and downs of illness, how do you handle those? How do you manage to be the person that wherever Celeste goes, you're ubiquitously there?
Well, Celeste has always been very independent. You use the word ferocious. That's where she is. And So I didn't become a true caregiver in terms of the time I spent on helping her daily activities until about a year ago when she fell in November. And I don't have any magic. I think I was blessed when I was growing up. My parents trained me to be independent. I remember when I was in junior high school, when I I ripped my pants, I fixed it myself. My parents were busy with their restaurant business, I cooked my own dinner, and I learned to do many things myself. So even before I was a full-time, but spent a lot of time taking care of Celeste, helping her with daily activities. I was a cook in the family. I did a lot of cleaning because I enjoyed it. So those skills came natural to me. The most difficult part about caregiving is really about the psychological state of your mind. What I wish that Celeste didn't have to fall and broken her bones. What I have wished that we were able to take a walk, holding hands in the neighborhood instead of me pushing her in the wheelchair. What I've hoped that Celeste could, like what we did before, drive up to the mountains, park the car, and then hike on Bruce Parkway, enjoy the scenery, the fresh air, talk about our lives. Yes, I do, every day. What, as Celeste just told you, what has driven her forward is her relationship with patients, her strong will to want to give. What drives me forward is my understanding that whatever journey I'm on, I'm going to learn something. I will be able to grow. So when I'm down, when I am feeling that I want to wish what I'm experiencing now away, I will stop and then ask myself, am I learning anything? Is it an opportunity for me to learn? And then if the answer is yes, then I say, okay, this is good. And I think working with Celeste, being a caregiver, you just heard what she told you. In a way, because of who she is and what she wants to do, actually makes my playing the caregiver role a little bit easier. She wants to make a difference, and I can see the value of her work, and I think we share that desire to make a difference. So in a way, I'm sort of her extender in a way to help her make a difference, and that's meaningful.
When somebody is on dialysis, the whole family ends up being involved with that dialysis process. It's true for so many illnesses. And as you go and sit in a physician's office, what do you think is the best way for a caregiver to really maximize the things that Celeste was describing earlier on, that there is somebody else in the room with the physician and the patient so that visit is maximized?
Yeah. Well, it has to be, you have to pay up with the patient. As a family accompanying Celeste to go to physician visits, Celeste has learned a lot about, she has tremendous amount of medical knowledge. It's amazing her understanding of medications, procedures, test results. I think her extent of medical knowledge is probably better than a physician who just came out of medical school. So I actually play very little role in understanding, communicating with physicians. And so what I see the role I can play is to listen first, observe the interaction, the Q&A back and forth between her and the physician, and then ask questions that may have missed in the conversation. That's sort of my strength. So I play my strength because I like to ask questions. And some of the questions are stupid, but when I don't understand, I like asking questions. And so in a way, that's sort of, I allow Celeste to be who she is, to do the best she could do. So it's really pairing up with the patient.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I can just chime in, I also think that, you know, Daniel and I are very good partners. And it's the same thing that we talk about with having, you know, partnership with your physicians. All of us as human beings, you know, my goal always is to put the humanity back in healthcare. But when you look at a caregiver and a patient's relationship, right, it can be challenging. As Daniel said, you now have changed the dynamic, right? You've entered this level of illness into our relationship. Even though I've had this going on a long time, I was able to do it all on my own, right? I didn't really need Daniel to be there. But I now need Daniel to be a part of what it is that I do, because I'm functionally disabled, which I've never been before, right? That's something that is so new to me, and it's new to him. So together, when you have a care partner and you have the patient, they have to redefine that relationship, and how a physician interacts with the caregiver and the patient is also different and new. And so what it is it's all about just being open and honest and having real conversations about how we can support each other in this relationship, right?
Celeste, you do know far more about about the disease in general, about dialysis as well, than a lot of the physicians who you may run into. Mm-hmm. Certainly in an emergency room, many primary care folks and sometimes specialists in rheumatology or nephrology. Mm-hmm. How do you help the physician or the nurse or the pharmacist, how do you help educate them in this engagement approach?
Sure. So what it is, you know, what I did, we just relocated here from Ann Arbor last year, and we were there about 5 years. And before that, we had been in North Carolina. But I was actually able to, when I went to the University of Michigan, I was able to help them lead and develop a patient family-centered care program that was for adult services, that was through the entire health system. So that was specifically for the point of care, clinical care. It was for research, and it was also for education, right? And it's absolutely asking that question. As a health system, how do we actually get our physicians, our care providers, our nurses to understand about patient-centered care, right, which is really about engaging patients, right? So instead of having a healthcare system-centric or provider-centric, and we just kind of plug the patients in to what we're going to do, we actually start at patient-centered. And that's what I would tell you. It's like to get true patient engagement, we as are you as healthcare providers and as nurses, and if we want to improve outcomes and we want patients to become more engaged, how do we reflect back on ourselves and look at the way that we bring them in and talk to them in the clinic when you're sitting there and talking to me as a patient? How are you doing that? And how are you making it a much more open environment for the patient to be engaged with you, right? How do we set up our clinic to make sure that they, do we embed peers in that clinic so that they really start to understand their illness and their care? How do we, on an inpatient floor, how do we do our rounds so that all of you aren't hanging outside while the patient's like trying to listen really hard what you're saying out there, and then you all come in like a movie, and the attending is right there and everybody else kind of fades into gray and is back to support the physician, but you have that conversation with the patient as opposed to maybe, you know, having the new ideas of bringing everybody into the room and actually engage the patient and the family in that rounding process. So not only are you mirroring to the patient and engaging them and listening to what students and residents have to do to report about their illness and do a round on them, but you're also mirroring to new young doctors to be how to actually do this work, right? So it's really up to the attendings, the senior physicians, to start to mirror what it is that you need to do. You know, when I tried to train and I did a lot of in services for physicians to talk about how do you operationalize this? Like, if you're telling me to do this, how do I do it? And I don't have time. Like, that's the biggest barrier or challenge. I don't have time. And I absolutely understand that. But one thing I can tell you is that if you've got 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you can make that 15 minutes feel like 30, or you can make that 15 minutes feel like 2. And it's all about your interaction with the patient. So that's, you know, and there's so many ways, and we don't have enough time here, but there are absolute tools that we can use to help physicians, nurses, and a system understand how to actually change the way we do our business in a way that encourages patient engagement.
Let's just take a moment, though, and list some of those approaches.
Of what you do?
Yeah, I mean, you've already named one, which is the reality that on the inpatient service, very frequently in teaching hospitals, the physician is with a gaggle of other physicians or physicians to be or nurses to be, talks extensively about you.
Right.
You can't hear it.
Right.
And then they emerge as if by magic through a otherwise closed door, which
right.
must be infuriating.
It's, you know what it is? Again, it's the isolation again, because it's almost like this is about you. There, you know, you've got all of these brilliant minds coming together to talk about you, and you're not a part of it. The one person that's missing in that conversation is the patient and the patient's family.
So you'd have rounds right there.
Right there at the bedside.
Right there. What else would you do?
So I'd also have, with those rounds, I'd also have an opportunity to do multidisciplinary team rounds so that you had all of the team, not only the physicians, but you would have the nurses, you know, respiratory therapy, OT, PT, care managers, like when you're looking to figure out what's going to be happening for the patient that day, to try to do those instead of doing them in the break room, to actually do them at the bedside. Because what that does, it's a lot of things that happen. One is you've got the family and the patient there. So as you guys are talking about it, or as the rest of the team is talking about what they're going to do that day, they may be able to chime in and say, you know what? I did that yesterday already. And they're like, oh, you know, so they can help with safety and quality, the patient can, and the family. And also the patient and the family hear what the plan is for the day. Because the most isolating thing in an inpatient bedroom is you're like, what's happening today? When am I going to get to go home? Nobody's told me. I don't know, you know, what's happening. But by listening and being a part of this conversation, they actually understand what's happening today. So they're not going to be pushing that button all day long, asking what's going on, when am I going to do this, what's the plan? They're part of the plan. They hear it. They know it. And I think that's really important. You're going to see the thread that goes through this is engaging and bringing in the patient and the family to a lot of the conversations that we have that we normally didn't do, right? So it's the same thing. Another opportunity within an inpatient setting is when you're having nurses doing their shift change, right? So you have one nurse, you know, the nurses are coming off at 3, other ones are coming on. They do their transitions and kind of hand, and this is what they hand off, you know, the patients. But to me, it's to hand over a patient, because when you hand something off, it's kind of you're shaking your hands, you're done. When you hand over, it means I'm entrusting you with the care of my patient. I'm handing it over to you, right? So that's what that process is. But you could also do that at the bedside. You can do the nurse, you know, transition at the bedside. One is one nurse introduces the other. The one nurse says, you know, invites the patient and the family to be a part of that transition. But they ask them if you could just keep all your questions until we transfer the information that we have so we don't lose it. And they're by the whiteboard in the patient's room. And so they're kind of telling what's happened today, what's going to be happening over the next 7 to 8 hours. The patients and the family are listening. Again, it helps in the quality and safety. But most importantly, what it does is it creates a relationship for the nurse and the patient and the family, right? And so they're kind of engaged together in what's going to be happening. So that's another way of engaging the patient in the inpatient setting. Now, another example, let me just say, if you're talking about in a clinic, in an outpatient setting, I'm a firm believer that we are missing the opportunity to embed peers in our clinical practice. We have so many patients who are type 1, let's just say type 1. So you have an endocrine clinic, you have a clinic day where you have a number of patients who've just been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. We have a number of patient advisors that we've brought on, which means these are patients, type 1 diabetes patients who are really good at being, you know, patient engaged. They understand about advocacy. We've trained them in peer mentoring. So they come on into our clinic and they have a little card. And it's a card from the University of North Carolina Endocrinology Diabetes Clinic, peer mentor, right? And this is not a paid position. This is volunteer. And these patients come in one or two days a week in the clinic. And so that when you have a new patient who's being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, that and they get checked in through the front of the clinic and they get brought into the room to wait for the physician, a peer can knock on their door and go in and say, hey, my name is Celeste. I'm also a type 1 diabetic. I've been one for 5 years now. Here's my card. It's got my email and my phone number. Please feel free to reach out and call me after you've gotten your diagnosis and you talk with your doctor. I'd love to help you at the beginning of your journey because I know it can be really hard, right? And so what does that do? One is it helps fill the time as a patient's waiting in the room, talking to someone that's meaningful for them. It also gives them the idea that they've just been introduced with somebody who it's like they've got the same like fist pump, you know, the same handshake. And that way, when they're listening to the doctor, they may not catch everything. But now they have this card of somebody who's going to be to help them get on the right journey for becoming an engaged patient who's type 1 diabetic, which we know could really increase their and improve their outcomes. So that's another example of improving patient engagement.
When you are trying to get other patients to get involved, mm-hmm. your advocacy role, how do you convince patients to want to be peer mm-hmm. Advisors?
You know what it is? You ask them. Nobody asks them. And if we ask them, they're like, I would really like that.
Is it better if a patient asks them, or is it better if a physician asks them, or is it some combination?
It's a combination. It's where the physician can help identify a patient who they think might be a good peer, right? Or might, you know, some of the best peers are the ones who are the least compliant, quite honestly, because they're non-compliant for a reason. So if they get matched up with a peer program, then that person's going to start to learn how to be a peer. But yeah, so it's a combination. So what you would do is we get referrals. There's a couple patients we think would be good, and or maybe a standard of practice within a clinic is that the paperwork that they get handed, one of the things they get is on peer support and saying, you know, we have this program, you know, so they can start off as receiving being a peer, but then they also have the option of becoming a peer. But so let's just say we have someone who's identified. We just ask and say, would you be interested in doing this? And they say, yeah, tell me a little bit more about it. So then you share what it's like to be able to help somebody else. You know, you talk about the isolation and loneliness, the tools and techniques that you've learned how to manage. What are some of the gifts that you bring, you know, to this knowledge that you've had in the experience of being a diabetic? How could you help somebody else? And what do you think the challenges are? And you start with those questions. And the main thing, you know, is to ask and then to train, right, to teach them and have them understand what their expectations are. Because that's really important. One thing I just want to say, what cannot happen if you're a physician and you're interested in changing something in your world and you want to engage a patient is you cannot just take your patient that you know is a really good patient, there's someone in your clinic, you get along really well with them, you think they would be really great patient engagement, and then you ask them to come along and do something with you without setting expectation, without training them on how to be patient engaged, without teaching them about the language. I mean, it's really a process and a procedure that as an organization, you need to actually create a way in which to educate these patients to be a part of a more systematic way of being a public, as we mentioned earlier, engaged patient.
Daniel, in your other life form, you're chair of a major department in the School of Public Health that trains young humans to become hospital administrators, or at least some of your trainees will become hospital administrators. How are you teaching them to design a system where patient engagement is part of the deal?
Yes, I'm the chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Geeling School of Global Public Health. I have to say that patient engagement should be more important part of our curriculum. And we teach a lot of hard skills. And I think we do a very good job of conveying hard skills to our students. So hard skills are like financial analysis, marketing analysis, statistical analysis, operational analysis. And what Celeste just described, I will classify as sort of soft skills, the understanding of human beings, the human needs, the strategies to engage people, patients in this case, in interaction with patients, as well as helping fellow patients to deal with their struggles, particularly at the beginning of the illness journey. Programs like ours should pay more attention to that kind of soft skills. And we still have a long way to go to build patient engagement and others' people management skills into our curriculum.
Yeah, I don't think we do a good job with our residents in the Department of Medicine teaching them these skills either.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a whole part of the educational process that is escaped as much attention as it needs. So you're right, Celeste. I've used the word patient-focused or patient-centered a lot, but it's not clear to me that we're really achieving that. Everybody worries about patient satisfaction scores. Mm-hmm. It's not clear to me that patient satisfaction scores actually equate mm-hmm. to what you've just described. How do we change our environment?
Yeah, because what it is you're absolutely correct, is what ends up happening, and even Daniel using the softer side, I call it the softer side of Sears, when we talk about patient-centered care, let's say about that, that promotes patient engagement, what we're really talking about here is a process that should sit in the Office of Clinical Affairs, right? Because nothing can happen unless we are walking hand-in-hand with the administrators on changing a system, because it's the system and it's the practice that are going to allow us to engage these patients to improve our outcomes. People start to, they really think about it as customer service, patient satisfaction. You know, they're trying to figure out the tools to manage or to evaluate how these things work. But the way that I try to tell people is that's not what we're doing. Because when you're talking about customer service, you're talking about patient satisfaction, especially now with value-based purchasing, with incentives, right? For me, it's always, what's the carrot to get people to do this work? Right now, it is the value-based incentives and how do we improve our outcomes and how do we improve patient satisfaction, et cetera. What those things are is you're doing things to the patient and you're doing things for the patient, right? So that's where we set up our practice. Like when you're talking about administrators, you're talking about, you know, how's our parking? How's the cafeteria food? How's the silence, you know, the quiet space? All those things are important. But it's as administrators and as people who are running a business, which we are, that's really doing, what can we do to do things to and for the patient to improve those things, right? What I'm talking about is something completely different. What I'm talking about is what can we do with the patient and the caregiver to not only improve the outcomes, but to truly make the healthcare experience and what it is that we're doing as physicians and administrators better, right? To have our patients with diabetes improve and not actually end up on dialysis. How do we actually have that quality and that safety start to be improved? And by having these people engage in a part of our team, it's a very systematic way of doing it. It's like bringing on a whole group of people and training them to be your team members.
How has your work helped you as a patient and as a person?
It's given me an absolute meaning and value to my life. I don't know what my life would have been like. This happened when I was 17, but it gave me a purpose and it's given me meaning. And I have to tell you, it has given me such glorious benefit of living. I feel like I have met incredible people in my journey, and I feel like we've made a difference, meaning all the other physicians and nurses and patients, all of us have made a difference. Because what is this life, really, other than trying to live it in a meaningful way? And I was handed a gift at 17 to say, yes, there's going to be some suffering. Yes, there's going to be some struggles. But we're going to give you a direction. We're going to give you a map. And you're going to go for it. And you're going to have an incredible life. And so for me, it's meant a real meaningful life. I'm 51. I don't know how much longer I have because I have a lot of complications going on. And I don't say that in a dramatic, like, oh, type of thing. It's the reality. All of us, here's the thing. The reality is that we all could get hit by a bus tomorrow, right? That's the only difference is I see the bus behind me. I see the lights. I just don't know when I'm going to slow down and it's going to speed up, right? That's the only difference is I see it. And I know its existence. But I've been so fortunate to have had the opportunity in the career that I've had to intertwine my personal and my professional.
What an inspirational thought. Celeste and Daniel, thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you very much. And as I was going to say, I have these two chairs of two departments. I hope UNC is going to be the leader in patient engagement within a health system.
Sold.